T.S. Eliot, Susan Sontag, Tom Wolfe, Joan Didion, Philip Roth, Jonathan Franzen. They're just some of the most prominent writers over the past seven decades who have something also in common, that they share a publisher, Farrar, Straus & Giroux, or FSG. In fact, FSG has published an unparalleled 25 Nobel Prize winners. Until his death in 2004, its founder and owner, Roger Straus Jr., was a celebrity in his own right, as famous for his tongue as for his publishing genius. New York Magazine contributing editor Boris Kachka writes about Mr. Straus and FSG's other formidable personalities in his new book called Hot House, The Art of Survival and the Survival of Art at America's Most Celebrated Publishing House, Farrar, Straus & Giroux. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it brings Boris Kachka to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thank you.
Can we really say that FSG is the most celebrated? Knopf also is a major contender, isn't it?
Well, we had to figure out some kind of subtitle. I think Knopf is a bigger publishing house. It stands for more. Farrar, Straus & Giroux focused in its heyday much more on literature alone.
Did Simon & Schuster publish your book in part because of its history as an arch rival to Farrar, Straus & Giroux? You write that Simon & Schuster was a favorite Straus whipping boy.
No, it was a coincidence. It mainly had to do with my editor, who loves the history of publishing. Simon & Schuster has gone through a lot of changes over the years, as has FSG. And as I say in the book, many publishing houses are now interchangeable, so it doesn't really matter as much.
Well, what did Straus have against Simon & Schuster in particular?
Simon & Schuster did everything that that FSG stood against, or that Roger stood against it at any rate. They bid up books, and FSG didn't participate in auctions, or tried not to. They stole his editors. They thought that they could buy prestige, and FSG was not about buying prestige. It was about earning trust and loyalty, or so Roger wanted the writers to believe.
Well, yeah, he didn't pay as well as many of the other publishers, even when the writers became famous. And Andrew Wiley, known by some in the business as the Jackal, poached many of Straus's writers. But Straus could have prevented that by just paying a bit more, couldn't he?
Well, it wasn't a bit more. And in fact, he managed to hold on to a lot of the writers even after they signed up with Wiley. In part, it was a negotiating strategy to keep things low. Susan Sontag got more money. Tom Wolfe got more money. Well, Tom Wolfe was with Lynn Nesbitt, but she operated in much the same way. But it was always in his interest to play that down so that he didn't have to spend as much as everybody else did.
Now, Roger Straus was famous for his colorful language and insults. Can't repeat many of them. And when he was on our show, we were worried about that. But he comes from New York royalty, not the sort of people you'd expect to talk that way.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I heard there was a radio show on profanity recently. It was a Slate's Lexicon Valley that they have. And one of the theories about profanity was that the people most likely to use it are either the lower classes or the upper classes. The lower classes, well, neither of them really have much to lose by doing so. So in a way, it was almost an expression of privilege that he didn't have to worry about what people thought of him.
And he did come from two very, very wealthy families.
Yes.
An alliance of the Guggenheims and the Strausses.
Yes.
They ran incredibly profitable companies like the American Smelting and Refining Company. Well, why didn't Roger go into one of the family businesses?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, why didn't he get the grades? Why didn't he go to Princeton? Why couldn't he get a college degree for several years? I just think that he was easily bored. He wanted to have things his own way. He wanted to be in an exciting business. He saw those people as plotters.
Did he show any interest in literature when he was young, when he was doing really poorly in school?
I think he did, but it was more the adventure stuff, the Steinbeck, the hardcore journalism, I think literature was sort of an accident for him.
And then he was 4F, but then he pulled strings to get into the military.
Yeah, that's right.
So the military is what got him into publishing?
Well, indirectly, I think he made a lot of his connections there. He was in PR for the Navy. He worked for a lot of writers, it happened to be a very transferable skill.
And then when he left, he teamed up with John Farrar with the idea that they would start a publishing house right after the war. Was that a good time to start a publishing house?
It was a very good time. There were many soldiers returning home, entering college, reading books. The paperback revolution had not quite gotten started yet. And I think it was a wide open time.
But his name is pronounced Farrar because
It is. It's Farrar, yes.
How did the company survive, Farrar, Straus and Company? Did they have some bestsellers from the start?
They did. Look Younger, Live Longer. And one of Roger's strokes of genius was to reverse that title. It started out as Live Longer, Look Younger, but more important to look younger. Fad Diet Book by Gaylord Houser. Lots of books like that in the early years that the later Roger wouldn't necessarily be so proud of.
And the company didn't become Farrar, Straus & Giroux until 1964. 20 years after after it was founded. But first there was Farrar, Straus and Young, and then Farrar, Straus and Cudahy. What happened to Young and Cudahy?
The easiest way to think of it is that they weren't committed to it, not the way that he was. They were people like him who were in the wealthy, cultured world and weren't used to working that hard.
And then Roger tried to woo Giroux into the company, and Giroux resisted.
He tried to woo him in 1946, and he resisted. He was on top of the world back then at Harcourt Brace, and he grew dissatisfied, and it became a lot easier.
Because of Catcher in the Rye.
Well, it wasn't just Catcher in the Rye. Catcher in the Rye was symptomatic of a lot of books that they weren't letting him acquire. In fact, on the road, his version of the story was that it was a misunderstanding between him and Kerouac. But in point of fact, Giroux's higher-ups wouldn't let him acquire it, and he had to save face by pretending it was his decision.
And then they wouldn't let him acquire Catcher in the Rye. These are books that can keep a company going for a very long time.
Well, hindsight is 20/20. I mean, if you could pick a 50-year bestseller, you're going to be rich.
So what kind of relationship did he have with Jack Kerouac? This was before Kerouac became a bitter anti-Semitic recluse, wasn't it?
Yes. Kerouac saw in him a bit of a mentor, but also a bit of a square, a sort of father figure to fight against a little bit, but someone to help him relate to the publishing world, which he needed to do.
Now, later, Roger Straus turns down Lolita. That's about as big a mistake, publishing mistake, as turning down Catcher in the Rye.
Well, it's a mistake a lot of other publishers made. I think the way he put it was no one in this town will touch this, and he usually knew what he was talking about when he said something like that.
These three men, Farrar, Straus and Giroux, came from very different backgrounds, had strikingly different personalities. Is that what made them successful?
Well, I hate to shortchange Farrar, although in the early years he helped a lot. But I think really the dynamic in the company was between Straus and Giroux. You needed someone with the attention to detail, the almost obsessive attention to detail that Giroux had. But you also need a showman and financier, of course, so Roger filled both those roles. They were complementary personalities.
They divvied up the responsibilities?
Yes, and it was much easier to do so in those years. Giroux really thought that, as someone said, publishing stopped after the copy editing stage, which obviously is not the case. You have to market a book, you have to sell it, you have to go on tour. Giroux preferred to sit there with his turkey sandwich and edit. Editors edit. That's what he said.
And so Roger was the showman of the company.
Roger had to throw the parties.
He also, despite his bad education, was obviously a smart man. Susan Sontag's son, David Reeve, called him an autodidact, the reader's equivalent of someone who listens to music and is pitch perfect.
Yes, he had very good instincts. One other observation on that is that when he was in school, the only class he was good at was extemporaneous speaking. He could just go on and convince you he knew everything about a subject.
You compare the way he judged books with the way a connoisseur tastes wines.
Yes, exactly. And that was Reef's perspective on it, too. You have to have some kind of feel for something, whether you have the education or not. And he had some education. I mean, don't get me wrong.
For almost from the start of the time they were in business, publishing was changing. It was becoming much more corporate. Houses were often felt it was too difficult to keep the quality writers if they didn't sell a lot of books. How did FSG keep it going?
Well, they had a little bit of a cushion thanks to Roger's contacts. It wasn't so much that he had to put money in every year as that he had a bank that held his personal finances. And so he had that kind of relationship where they kept lending.
So they were working at a loss and just drawing upon his fortune?
No, they broke even. And they were working in a system where if you're a hardcover publisher and you make the right kinds of paperback deals, you can pretty much break even for a long time. And they did. That's not how the business works anymore. But they would buy a book, leverage it, basically, and then sell it to a paperback dealer.
My guest is Boris Kachka, who's written a book called Hot House, The Art of Ferris, Strauss, and Giroux, The Art of Survival and the Survival of Art at America's Most Celebrated Publishing House. Roger's wife, Dorothea, called FSG a sexual sewer.
Yes.
Did Roger really encourage office affairs? Don't most companies discourage office affairs because they can get messy and cause a lot of tension and problems?
Roger... It was a complicated person. I don't know if he had some kind of grand scheme and he thought, well, if I have everyone sleeping with each other, then they'll be more loyal. There was a bit of a sort of sadistic element to him, as if he was watching a goldfish bowl, and FSG was his goldfish bowl.
But he was also a womanizer. At least he had a reputation for being one. Dorothea put up with that?
She did, although she wasn't always happy about it. I think that that was the nature of their marriage.
What about the other aspects of the family? Roger Strauss Jr. had a strained relationship with his father, and then he had a strained relationship with his son.
Right, right. Well, I tried to avoid sort of armchair psychology as far as I could, but that's what happens in families, I guess, especially powerful ones. You see it in a lot of different companies, by the way.
Well, Roger's father, Roger Strauss is junior, his father forced him to buy the family house, and then Roger went, the son, Raj, started working for his father when he's 15. For years, he managed the company's marketing and sales and seemed poised to inherit the throne at FSG. And then Roger brought in Jonathan Galassi.
Right. Well, he had to bring in Jonathan Galassi. In fact, it was Raj helped bring in Jonathan Galassi. It was only in the vacuum left by Raj's leaving that Jonathan Galassi became editor-in-chief. So I wouldn't necessarily say, although there are some people who thought he played them against each other, and that's part of his goldfish bowl.
So what happened with Raj?
Why did he leave?
Yeah, he left. Well, he didn't get the job.
Well, he chose to leave. Mm-hmm. They had one too many blowouts. Raj was trying to modernize the company. And Roger thought he was trying a little too hard, going a little too fast.
Sounds like Henry Ford and Edsel.
Yeah, I guess so. I could see it that way.
For decades, Roger was fiercely opposed to selling FSG, but then he relented in 1994.
Yeah.
Just couldn't keep it going?
Well, it's estate planning, partly. I mean, he knew that he wasn't going to be around forever, and Jonathan couldn't buy the company, so he had to do something with it.
Troubles continue, I guess, not surprisingly. Galassi had some difficulty managing Jonathan Franzen after they published the corrections because of the Oprah thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You hope for the kind of publicity that Oprah was giving that novel, and then Jonathan blew it.
Yeah, but you can almost picture if Roger were still around, how he might have handled it differently. The modern FSG is more about working towards success without alienating people, and that's the way they tried to guide Franzen. On the other hand, they backed him up in that battle. They thought that for the most part he was right. He was just expressing it the wrong way.
Isn't FSG more commercial now than it was before Roger's death?
Yes, sort of. They're more consistent about trying to publish all sorts of different kinds of books, trying to develop thriller series, things like that that Roger's FSG would never have tried to do.
Because the more commercial books pay for the more serious literary books.
Yes, and they always have, but in an era of annual budgeting, you have to have both in every year.
And right now, publishing is in serious trouble anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's going through a lot of changes. The question, authors will always write books. The question is how they'll be distributed to people.
Well, this is still a hardcover book with paper. It isn't an e-book yet.
There is an e-book available.
The book is Hot House, The Art of Survival and the Survival of Art at America's Most Celebrated Publishing House, Farrar, Straus & Giroux. My great thanks to Boris Kochka, who is its author. Its publisher is Simon & Schuster.
Thank you very much.